Hey, this is Garrett Abel, pastor of Seacoast Worship and Seacoast Music. First, I just want to wish you all a very Merry Christmas. And second, I just want to let you know that all the music you'll be hearing in these last two episodes is from Seacoast Music and can be found on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, or wherever you listen to digital music these days. Thank you so much for your support and Merry Christmas.
So a personal favorite verse is when Jesus says, "In this world you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world." This encapsulates perfectly, in my opinion, a very healthy and loving approach to the holidays when it comes to the various people we'll interact with. I love the holidays. It truly feels magical. I look forward to them every year. I know many people who feel the same way. Thus, in the event that the holidays are approaching without a loved one who has passed away, the feelings toward the holidays are just as extreme, but unfortunately not in a good way. It's actually a very painful time of mourning. And if that's you, we're remembering you right now. We love you and hope that you'll find some unexpected solace and peace as you walk through this time of grief. And with the deepest digging you can muster, we encourage you to take heart and have hope, because this baby we celebrate has overcome the world, and you will outlast your pain, as one day God will wipe away every tear. The old things of this world will have passed away. The sting of death is no more. And oh, what sweet and beautiful reunions await us. So the final two episodes of the year are centered around these two themes. One will be full of holiday cheer, hope, and laughter. But this first one, today, we're pausing to talk about grief. We have Kate Meyer, who is a licensed professional counselor and ordained minister, who recently wrote and released a book entitled Faith Doesn't Erase Grief, Embracing the Experience and Finding Hope. It's truly a warm and practical guide that outlines how to honor and affirm feelings of grief. It's perfect for those who are grieving, as well as for those who know loved ones who are in a season of grief. It's a blend of up-to-date grief psychology, biblical accounts, and everyday stories. We'll have the link to this book in the show notes, and I think you'll get a lot out of this conversation as we give the book a quick rundown and touch the tip of the iceberg of the natural, normal, but excruciating part of the human experience, and that's deep, dark grief. Also, through the duration of this episode, you'll hear some folks from Seacoast honoring loved ones who have passed on, sharing things they will miss about them this year. You'll also hear some Seacoast Christmas music, including a live version of O Holy Night. All the links to the music will be in the show notes as well. So our prayers are with you. Those who are grieving, we pray you'll find some comfort in listening to this conversation with Reverend Kate Meyer.
Just because I don't believe or agree doesn't mean I can't learn from you.
Why did you have to bring that up?
Okay, that one I'm super embarrassed about.
Do you like me?
Do I like you?
Yeah.
As an individual or
as a
podcast?
Yeah, just as a person.
No, I like you.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And I don't have any interest in appearing to be stronger than I am.
I ain't bowed to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. He gonna leave. You feel me?
How do we love people who see the world differently than we do?
What would it look like if we truly loved all of our neighbors? Could listening to their stories be the first step? This is Seacoast Church, and there's way more to talk about.
This is Karen Gadol, and my husband Bill Gadol passed away 8 months ago. So this is my first holiday season without him, and I will be remembering him with so much love. He loved spending time with friends and family. He loved laughing. He loved giving gifts to others and serving others. And he especially loved the joy of Christmas morning.
My name is Wendy. My mom, Mary Lou, passed away a little over a year ago, and I will be thinking about her and missing her even more over the holidays. One of my favorite memories with her was a mother-daughter Disney cruise I talked her into going on the year before we found out she had cancer. There was a long tubular water slide on that ship called the Aqueduct, and I talked her into riding it with me. She did notice that no one else in their 70s was waiting to ride it and was a little hesitant. I assured her that she wouldn't be any younger on our next Disney cruise. She reluctantly rode that aqueduct and had a ball. She even bragged to anyone who would listen that she was in her 70s and rode the aqueduct and they should try it too. I'm so glad we took that trip and had one more fun adventure.
Hey y'all, Joy Lynn Erickson here. And this year I will be thinking and missing my little black pug Sullivan Fitzgerald. He went to heaven on March 24th of this year, 2023. And it's going to be pretty tough.
My name is Jenna Surratt. My Grams passed away 11 years ago, and I always think about her during the holidays because she loved Christmas so much. I miss watching the joyous expression on her face when she opened gifts. No matter what she received, she always said, "I made out like a bandit."
Reverend Kate, it's so good to have you. And I'll tell you real quick before people get to start knowing you, I have a practice during the holidays. And I think it's because for me, like I really do, my whole life is geared towards the holidays from a standpoint of I'm always thinking about how many months away November the 1st is, because that's the beginning of the holidays for me. And I love, love the holidays. And I think because I love it so much and I'm so joyous, I take great measures not to go around trying to bum people out. I just got through saying I'm super happy. But when we gather as family, when we gather as churches, I always want to acknowledge if I had lost someone this past year, the amount of joy I feel right now would be in comparison to the amount of grief, because everybody else is happy. And this is a time where I'm supposed to be happy. Just a tradition. Gosh, I think you make the second episode that we will release during the holidays to talk about grief. And I don't know how I ran into your book. So I've been a pastor for 18 years and your book has one of the most needed titles when reflecting on my years as a pastor, just in itself is powerful. The book is Faith Doesn't Erase Grief: Embracing the Experience and Finding Hope. So you are an author, speaker, licensed professional counselor, and ordained minister. I was thinking about this topic. One of the worst things this world has to offer, grief has to make the top 10. That's just one of the worst things in this world. And it's one of those things that I see us being forever saved from, like that in heaven.
It's hard to imagine because it's so prevalent, especially right now. There's a lot of grief right now.
For sure. What unfolded in which you wrote a whole book on grief and from a spiritual perspective? And this book is not only helpful for people who go through times of grief, but I mean, you're also speaking to family members of loved ones and professional caretakers, pastors, therapists. I'll tell you a story for context. This is an extreme, extreme example. But to me, this has all the symptoms of really bad teachings about grief and this sort of thing. So I met a couple. They had been married for probably a year and a half, and they were having bad marital problems. And so I was helping them, counseling them through. I was like, how long have y'all been married, by the way? And they're like, a year and a half. I was like, well, wait a second. Your husband died, I thought you said, like 2 years ago. So basically, she got married so quickly because at the funeral for her husband, someone came to her with a prophetic word and said, "You will not have any grief. You get to walk in the joy and goodness of the Lord." And she claimed that.
Oh, it breaks my heart. I think part of the reason the church, capital C church, is so bad at it is because somehow we have associated, and I really think this is like decades, if not centuries worth of just flawed theology, that somehow if we grieve, if we're upset about something, that we're challenging God's sovereignty or will. So I think that has somehow snowballed into this, like, we should be longing for the time when we won't be suffering anymore. I don't think it's either or. I think it's both and. Like, we can be excited for and long for the time when none of that is going to be experienced anymore. And we are still here and we still have to go through it. And grief is nothing more than a natural reaction to a death or a change. And usually where I try and get my foot in the door is to say, if Jesus can grieve, and scripture's pretty clear that he does, why can't we?
Yeah. And I sometimes wonder, like you said, some of this theology is just layered for centuries and centuries. And I don't think we've done a really good job with teaching people that loving yourself is very important. In fact, it's the three things Jesus essentially said, the two greatest commands were love God and then love others as you love yourself. And it's like we've always had this knee-jerk reaction to that concept. So no wonder when we're going through grief, we see it as something, you know, I'm a bummer to everybody else. I'm inconveniencing everybody else. I need to just, and it's the most unloving possible thing that you could do to yourself.
Yeah. I tell clients all the time, going through grief is not selfish. People in your life will tell you that it is selfish. So regardless of that, even if you can't accept what I'm telling you that it isn't selfish, just know that if ever there is a time in your life to be selfish, it's when you're grieving, because grief is an entire being experience. There is not one part of you that is untouched by grief. And so you have to take the time to let it process, and you have to do the work. You know, people are just going to have to learn to deal with the roller coaster of your emotions and the days that you call and say, no, just kidding, I'm canceling that plan, I can't do that anymore, or whatever it might be.
And what is occurring to me now, and it's like, well, duh, that's an obvious, but you have to embrace the grief because it is going to be a part of your life forever. Doesn't mean that it has to destroy you, but it's going to be a part of your, like, I can't ever imagine getting over the loss of one of my kids. It will be a part of me.
Yeah. I very intentionally avoided the use of the phrase moving on or getting over it. Moving forward, moving through. Continuing forward is really my favorite, because it helps convey that idea that there's not an end goal that you're working towards. You're just continuing to progress, right? And so grief changes. That is the goal of grief work, is to have it change in its levels of intensity and duration and frequency, so that you can reach a point of re-engaging in life and opening your heart back up to love more people and being able to leave and engage again. But it's not about forgetting that person
right,
or the imprint that they had on you.
I totally get that. And I feel like how these folks have worded it with me is you get used to the pain. And when you start getting used to the pain, it's a little more manageable and you're able to re-engage and all of that. What do you think it is about human nature where people don't want to engage in the other person's grief? Because I've heard horror stories of families even saying things like, hey, you just have to move on. You have to get over this. And seeing them as an inconvenience that they come to Christmas gatherings and bum everybody out.
It's discomfort.
Yeah.
I coach clients on practice your response when somebody tries to stop your tears, or if they're telling you a story and you cry. And then they back off and stop telling the story. Practice your response to that. Practice the ability to say, this is just tears. Like this just happens now. And right. I really was enjoying that story. I want to hear that story. That is a part of my person that I've not had before. You need to keep telling me that story. And practicing phrases like, I might be sad, but I'm here, because being in the presence of all of you helps me. So,
all right. So the reverse, I'm just as curious about, like, what if someone sees their friend and they have given them time, they have given them space. It's nothing but concern. It's not, hey, I'm uncomfortable to engage. It's not, man, they're such a bummer to me. I wish they would be happy so I could be happy. It's true concern. Like, that person is not re-engaging. How would you encourage someone to approach a situation like that?
That's a great question. I think it's looking at the signs. So this is going to be a roundabout answer, but introverts and extroverts have different needs in grief. You know, introverts have to go inward for a long time in their grief. Introverts have that need. Extroverts have a different need. So pay attention to that, right? The person that you're concerned about, is it simply that they need to be alone more? Are you seeing signs either when you see them or when you've been in their home? Are they keeping up with bathing? Is their house clean? Are they eating? Are they drinking water? If any of those things aren't happening, if they are completely out of character for themselves, that's when you come to them and say, I know that your world has been shattered, and I know that I don't understand it, and I can't. I need you to know that I am worried about you. And I'm worried about some of the ways that this is showing up. I want you to have what you need to cope with your grief. I also need for you to have the things you need to continue living.
I wanted to make this even trickier for us, because I love, that was brilliant how you articulated that, and just a great way of approaching it. If that person doesn't respond in a healthy manner, are you ever an enabler?
I think that you can. And I think that happens because we have a hard time walking that line that you were just pointing out, that some of us get so worried that we're going to say the wrong thing that we don't say anything. But when it's concern for their safety and their health, you don't have to back down on that. Be gentle, but you don't have to back down on it. And it can be as simple as starting with, I'm going to come over and clean your house today. They don't have to participate. They don't, like, I'm going to come and I'm going to clean your house. And then see how that impacts them. It's possible that they are just so overwhelmed that the thought of finding a place in their home to begin cleaning is far too much, and they just can't do it.
Yeah.
So it very well could be that if you go and you clean that house and you do those dishes and you fill the refrigerator, that might be enough.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So I've got some very specific things. I have not read the book. I am going to read the book, but I feel like everything that I was looking into was extremely, extremely intriguing. So basically, a lot of the things I'm throwing your way are things that I've read about the book and what people have said. It sounds like your book talks about how you can accept and embrace emotions. Does this ever teeter into should? And I don't mean like should, like, you know, if you don't, you should be ashamed of yourself. But I'm saying for your own good, would should be a better word than can?
Yes and no. I really despise the word should.
Yeah, no, I get it.
Because of what the example you just gave, like it's so misused that I really don't like it. However, that being said, we do need.
I'm really glad you stood firm on that, because I need to hear that. Everybody needs to hear that. And that's great.
Yeah, it's just, I have a rule in every support group I run. There is no should. Doesn't exist.
You cringed. I bet you cringed when I just said it, didn't you? Didn't you?
That being said, the reason there is an entire chapter dedicated to emotions and tools, multiple tools that are dedicated to learning about them and expressing them, is because they are a necessity. You know, it goes so far back. There are branches of Christianity that somehow came to this concept that we're not allowed to have emotions. And even if you can have them, you certainly aren't allowed to express them. So there's that branch, and that's really hard and unhealthy. And then there's the mental health aspect of, you know, if people don't express their emotions, then whatever it is they're dealing with, depression, anxiety, OCD, all of it just gets bigger, and takes more control. So felt very necessary to me to start with some foundational things. You can love God and hate grief, and you have to know what your emotions are. That is the foundation. Those are the first three chapters, foundation of the book, because it's just crucial to the whole experience.
Do you use the terminology grief literacy?
I do, not in the book, but I do use that. Yeah.
Gotcha. I love that, because it matches some of the things that I wanted to get in with you. Is it's like, I think it's safe to say I've been through some very, very tough things, you know, with mental health, but I've never lost a child. I've never lost a spouse. And given I don't have that experience, I truly believe there is a whole lot of stuff. I cannot understand. So I have to listen to people like you and people who've experienced grief in order to be educated, and then still try to understand because I can't feel what they're feeling.
I want to be very clear, though, that you still grieve, right? So even when there is not that significant loss or that big loss, secondary grief is a very real thing, right? Witnessing the grief of the people in your sphere can cause your own grief. And so I think we do a lot of that. I think we minimize a lot of our own grief experience because we say, but it's not that bad. I'm not going through what they're going through. Well, no, you're not. You're not walking their road, but you still have grief that you need to process, because when we process our own stuff, that's how we become better helpers, right? So as you mentioned, the book is absolutely for grievers. It is also for helpers. I would say almost equally for helpers for that reason, because to be a efficient helper, you have to do your own grief stuff too.
My name is Adam Martin, and in 2023, my friend Lori Fitzgerald passed away. And I know that my family and I will be thinking about her during these holidays. One thing we'll miss about her is that she had this unique blend of sass and sarcasm and yet selflessness all at the same time. She would be the first to call you out and also the first in line to help you out. And so we were always grateful to count Lori as a friend. She didn't have an easy life. Lots of things were challenging for her, like so many of us, but she had a way of getting through it by reminding herself that God's got this. It was a phrase that none of us will ever be able to hear again and not think of Lori. So we're so grateful for all that she taught us, the fact that we still get to carry her memory with us, and we'll be celebrating that during these holidays.
My name is Perry Page. I lost my wife of 47 years, Rosamond Page. Many of you knew her. She passed away December 1st, not too many days ago. What I will miss most about her is celebrating Christmas without her, because she had an incredible gift of hosting and hospitality. And I'm just now realizing that I've been riding on her coattails all these years. And on a lighter note, do ladies have coattails? Anyway, Merry Christmas.
So you would say levels of grief would be like, it's on almost like a continuum. It's not good to second guess your grief and minimize it. It's grief. It just, there's just different levels.
Yeah.
So would it be safe to say then that on a scale of 1 to 10, I would see the couple who lost their child as they've experienced a level of 10. Mm-hmm. I probably could relate up to maybe 6 or 7. I do not know what 10 feels like. I don't ever want to know, because the only way I would know is to lose my own child. So there is a dynamic of their being and how they think and what they carry around with them that I can't fully understand. I mean, I'm asking as a question.
Yeah, we can't fully know. Absolutely not. We cannot fully know. I think our empathy, I think our similar experiences, I think all of that contribute. And I think we go a long way in helping one another if we can acknowledge what you just said. My brain cannot fathom what you are experiencing right now. Can't do it. I still want to be here for you. And I know I'm going to mess it up sometimes. So feel free to correct me when I do, or tell me when I do.
You touch on how the actual body is affected by grief. Like, are there any biological stuff you can tell us? Like, I mean, how it affects the heart, the brain? I mean,
there is a book that when grievers are ready, I tell them to read. Every helper, I think, should read it. It's called The Grieving Brain. And this is a woman who focused her research on what happens to the brain when we grieve. So it validated things that we have always suspected, that not only is your body flooded with chemicals at various times throughout the grief road, but your brain has to do new mapping, right? So my favorite example from this book is when you move into a new house, you kind of turn lights on, right? When you get up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, you turn on a light because you know that you don't know for sure where you're going. Quickly, you figure it out. You don't have to turn. You can navigate your whole house with the lights off until someone comes in and rearranges the furniture. And now you're stubbing your toe all the time, right? We make little connections all the time. Oh, the garage door is going up. My person just got home from work. So now every time you hear that garage door, around that time, your brain has to now learn that's not what that means. He's not home. Or to see the clock get past 5:30 and for your brain to realize 5:30 is no longer like that. That's not a key time anymore. They're not coming home anymore. So it's an amazing, daunting reality of And I think validation, I think, you know, when I give these examples to grievers, there's just this relief that washes over them of, okay, so all this time when you've been telling me that I am not going crazy, now there's scientific proof that I am in fact not going crazy, because your brain is just overwhelmed and needs to figure it out. Your brain is doing stuff. I encourage people to get a physical if they've not had one in the last year, especially while you are practicing how to identify and express your emotions. They can manifest in your body and do weird things to heart rate and blood pressure and pain and illness, right? Psychosomatic responses are very real. So get that physical and just know, where am I? Are there any flags I need to be paying attention to?
Yeah.
It shows up.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Liz is our dear friend whose husband passed away. And there are certain things that I recall so clearly during those days, and I will just bring them up to her kind of casually, you know, warn her, hey, can you talk about these sorts of things, been thinking about them, whatever. But she has no recollection. And I'm like, how can you not remember this? And it's because her brain is really devoted to some other things. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just limited to the sorts of memory that it can take in.
Well, and so a piece of that is that kind of thing usually happens when there is still a whole lot of numbness happening. I mean, she was not fully present within herself during that time, I imagine. But the way you started that to say, I usually will say to her, can I tell you the story? And that is so important. That is, if helpers hear anything, that's what I want them to hear. Just ask the person. The griever will tell you, today is a bad day. I can't hear any stories today. But most of the time, even if it causes them to cry, even if it brings them pain, you are either bringing back a good memory or you are giving them a part of their person that they never had, because you were doing something with their person and they were not there. So now you're giving them a story. And for someone who is trying to swallow the reality that they aren't ever going to make new memories with their person, the fact that they can receive new pieces of information is huge.
Yeah. And I will say, I learned the hard way as far as knowing you just can't bring that stuff up. And I will still make mistakes sometimes. The content of this book, the people that are listening, I think many of them are going to want to get this book. So I don't think that we need to get too in the weeds, because I want to get to some other questions. But early grief, middle grief, and lasting grief, what are the relevance of these different stages, and why is it good to know the differences of them?
Yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding, not only in the, you know, just kind of generally speaking about, Kubler-Ross's stages of grief have been misapplied. She's so gracious. She was in her life so gracious about it, but they've just been misapplied all these years. And so I present this idea of these phases of grief, because phases are transitional and they have open borders, because grief is not, you know, there aren't these nice little markers as you go along the way. Sometimes you do slide back. Sometimes you kind of straddle two places at once. So early grief, middle grief, and lasting grief are by way of capturing kind of the standard trajectory that people go through, where early grief, the key word there is just survival. Do the things you have to do, feed your body, hydrate your body, bathe, connect with the people most important in your life, pay your bills. I mean, there are certain deaths where paying your bills is one of those, like, really set a reminder for that. Early grief is survival. For most people, you know, that's the first maybe 2 months. It can go up to 5 months, depending on the types of loss and all of that. Middle grief is the big chunk. It is the marathon. I put a focus word of try for middle grief, because that is what you're doing. You are trying all of the things, trying old experiences in a new way, trying new experiences, trying to get out of the house for the first time, or for the extroverts among us, trying to stay in for the first time, right? Because extroverts will do anything they can to not have to just sit in their grief in their home alone.
Wow. Gosh, that is so crazy. I mean, that's completely reversed, isn't it? That makes so much sense. I would not want to be around anyone. Gosh, yep. And I know the people who would want to just bury themselves in interactions and distract themselves.
Yeah. Throughout early and middle grief, you are also working kind of behind the scenes a little bit at establishing a continued bond or connection with the person who died to whatever level of need you have for that, right? Some people don't need that. Some people need it just in the beginning, and then it kind of fades away. Lasting grief is that place you eventually kind of slide into. There's not, you know, you just kind of wake up one day and realize that you're there. And some of the markers for that are you are amazingly to yourself, able to look, live in the present and look ahead again, instead of always just being in the past. You have learned that if you need to access your person, if you need to spend time with them, if you need to tell them something, you've learned how to do that in a way that you know isn't transitory. It's not going away. So you can more freely move about your life and re-engage, because though physically they are gone, right? That's a key aspect of early grief. Physically, they are not coming back. It's accepting that and learning that. Middle grief and lasting grief is about, okay, yes, physically they aren't here, and there are many other ways that they show up.
Yeah. Tell me more about those. You say that they're continued but changed bonds that many grievers experience when their loved one is gone. Give us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. This was really important for me to put in the book. And I've had people say to me, have you had any pastors like just call you a heretic? Or I'm like, well, no. They either just throw the book down when they get to that part, or they don't want to talk to me about it. And the reason for that is because I had so many clients who are believers sit across from me and kind of just almost shamefully tell me about a moment that they had the week prior where they felt their person's hand on their shoulder, or, you know, they sensed a response that their person said to them. I had one woman tell me about, she said it wasn't a hallucination. It wasn't a vision. It was more just like he appeared. And then he was gone. Just kind of this, okay. So this opening of the fact that we live in this already not yet state, right? We know the end. We know that Christ is coming. We know that that heaven is real, and whatever that means, that there will be a new earth, whatever that means, right? We don't have a clue. But in this in-between time, you can be connected in a way that you need to be. So whether that's openness to how they might show up, whether that's openness to it's okay if I sense that or feel that, whether it's just looking around you and seeing your person reflected in legacies they left or other people in your world, there are aspects of them that are tangible.
Yeah, all of that makes sense. I've heard so many people talk about the presence of a loved one. You know, I want to get people a full picture of this. I mean, you are bringing in biblical stories. There's seven apprentices with tools for coping. I mean, you've got working with 1 Corinthians 13, Psalms 23. You even have like it's kind of a step-by-step. Like if somebody wanted a handbook, and I know that you're not saying there's like a one-size-fits-all, there's not a formula, but this really can be a resource for people to read it, ingest it, and interact in the Bible as they do it. Do you think the partnership between our Christian faith and psychology, do you think it's still got a lot of making up to do?
Yes.
It just seems like there's still a ways to go, doesn't it? Doesn't it feel that way?
There's so far to go. You know, in the Reformed circles, the phrase all truth is God's truth, right? And the problem with that, I love that, but the problem is there are a lot of people who don't think that science is true. So that doesn't do us any good, right?
Right.
So yeah, I wanted very intentionally to show those who are open to it how in line with scripture psychology actually is. You know, as much as Paul is not my favorite person. Let's start there. As much as Paul is not my favorite person, he does exemplify some of the things that I talk about, such as learning to control your thoughts and expressing your emotions. The Bible is filled with emotional expression, and yet somehow we're not very good at it. It's filled with evidence that we can be changed, and that change, though we're given the capacity to do so through the Spirit, it also takes effort on our part. Like that, it's so abundantly clear to me in Scripture. But I know that there are people for whom that's not the case. But to me, it's very clear. Yes, we are empowered to do it, and we have the ability because the Spirit gives us that. But it's not a one and done thing. Like, we have to do stuff. The change just doesn't happen.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting. Like with the mental health stuff, I'm very hesitant, kind of hesitant to read Christian literature. I know there's really good stuff out there, but I just can't read stuff where people are really glossing over the psychology. And I'm not saying throw away the spirituality, but hey, let's embrace them first. But I have recently ran into a couple of gyms. And both of them, I think, are therapists, and they just went. I mean, my eyes were open to all of the sound scientific mental health stuff that you can find in the New Testament. I was like, oh my gosh, I've seen these verses, but you know, like for example, I mean, taking one day at a time. Holy cow, if we all just did that, or you know, making your thoughts obedient to Christ. I mean, that's basically saying, hey, you need to take inventory of your thoughts. You just can't let them be floating around. You got to do something about it. You've got to take your thoughts captive. That's good mental health coaching right there, you know?
I mean, just the phrase in and of itself says that we can, right? And instead of that kind of more defeated stance of, I don't know, that's not even something we can do. We are who God created us to be. No. We, at our core, we are who God created us to be, but there's so much that we still need to get rid of and learn. And, but I'm that person too. I cringe at like Christian radio and Christian literature and that kind of thing only because I fear that it's going to be more of the same. And so that's why I needed to find a unique publisher who was going to allow me the space to do both of the things and to show how interwoven they truly are.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy these episodes, we'd love for you to leave us a rating and maybe even a comment. We've loved the comments that have come in so far. There's also a link in the show notes to our podcast Facebook group where we talk about these episodes and we share some behind-the-scenes information, including guests that we're booking. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.